the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day, 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Sake On Air, broadcast with the support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association. From here at their Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center in the heart of Tokyo. My name is Chris Hughes, and joining me here today, we have on my left...
Christopher Pellegrini, resident Shochu and Awamori nerd. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. And then on the right-hand side of Chris, we have...
Hi guys, this is Marie Nagata. We're back again for an episode on terror today.
Yes. Wonderful. And then on Marie's left hand side.
Hi, my name is Eli Nigren. Currently work for Chiyo no Kame Shuzo in Ehime Prefecture. And then, sake fan and brewer.
Wonderful. So yeah, we're very honored and privileged to have a guest host with us today to help us debate today's topic. So yeah, we're very pleased to have you, Eli.
Very honored to be here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for making the time. Come on. And then, of course, on the left-hand side of Eli, we have...
Hello, everyone. This is Sébastien Lemoine, and today, particularly happy because we're going to discuss a word from my language.
What are we going to discuss today, Sébastien?
You're going to laugh at all of us mangled pronunciation on the word terroir.
I'm going to have to teach you first how to pronounce it.
Okay.
The word is terroir.
Terroir. So we are going to be, rather daringly, I might add, digging into the topic of terroir. We will actually start today by kind of decoding it, and then we'll dive into a discussion, or rather a debate, on whether or not there is a terroir in the sake world, and whether or not we should have a terroir, and is there a point in having it, and why do we have a terroir, and then, you know, when we're really just going to be laying out the groundwork in this episode for future episodes, because this is a topic that you can't possibly cover in one 50-minute, one-hour session. And the thing about the sake terroir is we've only just started debating it in the sake world. We've only just started talking about it. So, yeah, this is the episode that kind of launches our foray into the topic of terroir. So without further ado, I would like to ask Sébastien to explain from a French perspective, you know, what does it mean?
I believe that terroir, the word, only exists in French, even in Spanish or Italian. There is no equivalent, although both countries are quite close in terms of their culture for winemaking and gastronomy. Something which is really specific of terroir is that it comes from the word terre, so which is earth, but it's much more than just a soil or a place. It's basically an alliance. It's an alliance between man and a natural environment, is the way man has cultivated the environment that makes terroir. And that environment is a place, a soil, a climate, and other natural elements.
Wonderful. Beautifully put. And actually, we have the word terrain in English. So I was wondering, are they maybe similar? Does terrain come from terroir? Maybe some of our linguists listening could maybe write in and let us know.
Well, terrain is definitely referring to the topography of a place. Yeah. I think it's more topographical than it is terroir, which you were saying is everything around. It's the climate, it's the soil, it's the water basin, it's the water table. But you also said something very interesting before. You were referring to taste as well.
Mm. We can look at it from the terroir of that produce is this place, but what really is more interesting for the consumer or helps selling that terroir is the taste that is associated with it. And we're always shifting between the two concepts, and sometimes makes it a little bit confusing to distinguish between the two conversations.
That's right. And actually, John Gortner wrote a very good article all the way back in 2014 on this topic. And I think he described the terroir perfectly, actually. And he says that it is local, human, and natural factors that give a product unique characteristics that make that product's origin identifiable, basically tying that product to a place. And I have another very, very much shorter definition I found on the internet, which seems to appear quite a lot, which is a taste of place. And it's definitely, even in winemaking, terroir is not just about the soil, right? It's about the climate, the local surroundings, cuisine, people, culture, history. Have I missed any? So I think it's a lot
and,
more.
I mean, the way the soil has been cultivated as well, right? Because you don't grow, if we talk about wine, grape, the same way, depending on what the soil looks like, the soil composition is.
And it's not just a, terroir is not just a wine concept, although it originated in wine. You've now got beef terroirs, cheese terroirs, coffee terroirs, beer terroirs, obviously.
Olive oil.
Olive oil terroirs as well. I actually found an example of an olive oil terroir, which I think was really interesting. So I'll just read out. An olive grove where peach trees actually share the terroir with the olive trees produces olive oil, which takes on fruity characteristics. That's really interesting.
That's crazy. Huh.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? And of course, you know, in the case of a coffee terroir, it's all about like the roasting altitude and the kind of the temperature and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of different factors that go into the terroir. But anyway, the question that we want to debate in today's episode is, where should we be looking for the sake terroir? Who wants to kind of start me off? Where do we start with this?
Where do we start? It's such a big topic to really tackle on. And you mentioned a taste of a place, right? And that there is certain traceability to characteristics of a certain terroir. But also, to what extent do we expect there to be traceability of a certain regional characteristic? And, you know, I do miss having John here today with us, because one of the things that really stuck in my mind when I took his certified sake professional course, there's nothing that's 100% certain insofar as sake flavor profiles go. Like, you can have a Ginjo that doesn't quite taste like your perception of Ginjo or a usual standard of what we would expect a Ginjo to be like. Or you can say the same thing about Yamada Nishiki sake or Yamahai sake. So with all of those ambiguities that we play with in the sake world, exactly to what extent do we expect there to be a certain defining characteristic?
You're completely right. If there is a terroir in sake, even if it did exist, it's going to be very, very diluted just because of the fact that the sake, the flavor is very subtle, you know?
Right.
Very ambiguous is the right word, I think. And the whole concept of terroir is kind of ambiguous in the first place, isn't it? Because like you say, they don't define the extent to which you should be able to, you know, pick up these characteristics or trace the origin.
If I could just add, I would say that when you're talking about this topic in relation to sake, I like to try to keep it simple and to back up and say, okay, how can we, since there is no clear definition, we can start by looking at simply the ingredients of the beverage, right? And so one of the first key ingredients obviously is rice.
That's what I had down in my plan, so let's go ahead with that, right? So yeah, let's talk about the rice. So if you were going to talk about wine, you talk about the grapes, right? So that's the equivalent in sake, if you like. So one key difference between, I think, the grapes and the rice is the fact that, unlike grapes, you can transport rice over large distances, and you know, you can basically take your rice anywhere, can't you? And traditionally, that's what's always kind of happened. And so the argument is, even if you say there is such a thing as a terroir based on the rice, you could have a brewer 7 prefectures away who is able to get that same rice, and then technically, couldn't he produce the same characteristics in his or her sake?
So yes, if you only look at the rice type, varietal, written on the label, you cannot draw a conclusion from that. That being said, I'm still convinced that a particular rice, but not, I don't mean the name of the varietal, but the rice that is actually used for production is a very important element of the style and the taste of the of the sake. So part of the terroir, definitely.
One of the conditions, well, one of the rules you often see when people are talking about terroir, though, is site specificity. It's massive. Like, you hear about wineries that, you know, the same wine being made basically with grapes from 5 different vineyards or 5 different plots of the same vineyard, only like 5 meters apart, having completely different characteristics, and then saying that you can only produce those characteristics with this particular site. Could you do that with sake? Because like, the being able to transport them over large distances,
I'm not able to answer that question.
Well,
and I think to that point where you mentioned, you know, some plots of a vineyard next to each other could produce very different results of grapes. I think there's more to it than just how, like, geographically apart they are, because you have to take into consideration how old the vines are and what kind of damages, if any, have been to the vines, and what are the, you know, sunshine versus, you know, rain, because different patches of land get different sunshine. So it's difficult to compare to rice, because rice is a plant that grows and dies within a year. So,
and you generally can't grow it on the side of a hill.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. I think it's actually impossible to grow some varieties of grapes in some parts of the world,
right?
Because of the climate or whatever. Yamanenishiki is a difficult one, because it is impossible to grow that all over Japan. Most of the other rice varieties that I know will pretty much grow anywhere in Japan. So there, it's very difficult to kind of, you know, say, well, we use this particular rice type because it only grows here. And that's a big part of the 2R. Making the wine the way you make it, or making the product the way you make it, because the ingredients are only sourceable in that particular area. And that's what you have to work with.
Right.
Also, if we look at it from a historical point of perspective, I think it's very different in the way that rice is used to make sake and the way that grapes are used to make wine. When sake brewing first started, I think basically it was just rice that was left over, right? And they wanted to find a use for that, so they started making sake or whatever. And if you kind of go further ahead in the history, then it's mainly people just sourcing, being given the rice from a cooperative or whatever. If you go all the way back to the origins of sake, the beginning of sake brewing, there's very little emphasis on actually purchasing a particular type of rice because it has particular characteristics.
What I want to say is scientists are actually contributing to the story of terroir for sake. We were together at the Akita Sake Annual Sake Party in Tokyo a few months ago, and we tasted this two sake is made from new rice types. And clearly, Japanese scientists are the kings of crossbreeding in terms of rice. And most of the sake rice that are being used today are fairly recent. They've been developed in the last 70 years or so. And you could clearly see that these two rice types developed by the Akita Research Bureau, or whatever they're called, were meant to be grown in Akita and best express an Akita style. So they're actually contributing to the
style. That's amazing.
I think that's definitely true. We can't say 100% though, because we haven't tried to grow them anywhere else, right? So we can't say 100% that that's the case, but there's definitely something there. And especially the rice varieties had characteristics which suited the style of sake that they were making in Akita as well. That's probably key.
Another thing I wanted to say is, if there is a key element when I think of wine is, we talk about a region, we talk about a grape type, grape varietal, and not much else. Mm. But that's not at all how we define a sake. In Japan, especially over the last, I don't know, since the war, I would say, we define a sake about how it's made, its production process. We don't talk about ingredients so much.
There you go.
We talk about polishing rate. We talk about the yeast starter type. We talk about, has it been filtered? Has it been pasteurized? Has it been diluted? That's what's come first as information. Mm. That's the focus, more than the ingredient, I think. And so the conversation comes up today because I think the world of sake needs terroir to go to another stage. But until recently, maybe the terroir as a word was not necessary in the sake world.
Definitely, absolutely. And you know what, though, I found really interesting during my research is that there are actually people in the wine world debating whether the terroir actually exists. Can you believe that? And they're saying, basically, a lot of people are saying that, well, yes, there are a lot of convenient coincidences in there, right? Mm. Which may be true of a terroir. But actually, in most cases, in a lot of cases, I'll say, the house style actually overrules the terroir, now however strong it is, right? And that's definitely the case in sake.
I think one of the reasons that this this concept is starting to be become discussed more frequently and we're starting to see it on sake labels is because the market itself is starting to get more competitive and everyone is trying to find a way to set themselves apart, right? And that's both for the domestic sake brewing market and for the overseas market. I would say it's true for both. And so one of the ways that people are doing it, you know, we were just talking about traditionally up until this point, most of the focus has been on, you know, the polishing rate or, you know, other factors. But one of the ways that people are starting to do that now is by highlighting these other factors, right? And that I think, you know, we all understand how difficult it is to define this concept. But one of the ways that that is can be talked about is through, say, rice variety, for example. And so certainly, you know, I've seen a number of breweries that will, you're talking about the rice in Akita, you know, highlighting a rice variety that is, say, specific to that area and has not been grown anywhere else or is currently not grown anywhere else. That's not to say that it couldn't be in the future. So that's certainly one way that people are highlighting it. And I think they're doing that to, again, it's sort of a marketing technique. Definitely. And a way to set themselves apart from the competition.
I recently visited Matsuno Tsukasa down in Shiga Prefecture, and I definitely saw evidence of a terroir there. I mean, you know, they are openly exploiting the concept, and they grow their rice in different plots of land, and each plot of land has a different soil. In composition.
Oh, wow.
And it's based entirely on the French red wine system that you see in like Pomerol, I think, isn't it? On the east side of the, I get the name of the river wrong. It's the Gironde, isn't it? Right? The Gironde. And so I tasted this sake from each different plot of land. Very, very different. Now, I'm not sure I could pick out the exact characteristics, but very different. And when he explained kind of when the Shacho explained, you know, basically how he was using these different soil compositions to create these different styles of sake. It made complete sense. Give you an example. And exactly the same as Pomerol, the way they make the red wine there. So one of the soil consumptions contains a lot of clay, which has less drainage, right? So you get less water drainage, you get less mineral nutrient drainage. And so the end sake ended up being much more kind of rich, if you like. And then you had the opposite, with kind of sand or loam or whatever. And then you ended up with a much kind of lighter, drier style. Now, that's still a very vague description of a sake. You know, you need to look closer at the individual characteristics. But for me, that having recently done a lot of wine study, I saw definite evidence there of a terroir. But it is a wine-inspired terroir. So whether it's the right one for sake, I don't know. And before we talk about water, actually, I wanted to go to Chris. Sorry, I forgot to do this. I wanted to go to Chris and have a look at the shochu in the shochu world. You have used lots of different ingredients to make shochu. So
yeah, that's definitely true. And so there's a different story based on whichever base ingredient you're talking about. I mean, you could be talking about water chestnut shochu, or you could be talking about aloe shochu. The biggest seller in Japan is sweet potato shochu. And there's one GI ascribed to that, to sweet potato shochu made in Kagoshima. It's called Satsuma shochu. All the sweet potatoes have to be local. The water, the koji has to be made locally. So it's more of a regional protection thing, which is very common for AOCs as well, for GIs, right? So in my understanding, there's two aspects to this. There's a geographical protection element, and then there's also the marketing element that we talked about before. And different places are trying to create their own terroir story. When I worked in the beer industry in the States, you know, our uniqueness was in our water, and we protected that. We tested it every morning, and we panicked when something felt a little bit off, and we would have to approach the water with different techniques for getting it back to where we wanted it, different osmosis and different treatment techniques that are quite costly and time consuming. But, you know, sometimes we had to pour out beer. You had to kill beer, you know, pour it straight down the drain because
it was that important.
It was that important.
Wow, to highlight.
Oh, absolutely. You cannot let your customers down by, you know, that's their hard-earned cash, and you're just going to be, well, this one's not how we normally make it. You can't put that in the bottle. So there was that element there. So I kind of come from this protecting your brand, protecting your region with whatever you can. And the shochu industry has many of these conversations going on. and sweet potato is probably the best established. But then again, in Kagoshima, it's just sweet potatoes grown in Kagoshima. There's like 5 dozen varietals being used right now, from the super, super white as this paper to the garnet, most purple thing you've ever seen in your life. They create completely different drinks. And that's not even taking koji into consideration. But for me, and if I maybe I'm jumping into another rabbit hole here, but for me, the biggest thing always since my days in the beer world has always been yeast.
Okay.
And that's yeah. For me, that's huge, because yeast, you can take the same starch source and, you know, brew it separately with two different types of yeast, and you get two completely different drinks.
Yeah. And that's, it's, I think, a perfect
gigantic
kind of segue to talk about yeast and how that relates to terroir and sake.
Sure.
Because,
I don't want to jump over water.
Okay.
I don't want to jump over water.
Because, whoa, hold on.
Because, guys, sake is 80% water, is it?
Oh, you're certain.
It sure is.
Okay. So, at least.
So on that fact, based on that fact alone, surely the real terroir is in the water.
I think, well, as we know with all alcohol, wherever there's good water, you're going to have people making alcohol, basically. Yeah. And I think there are several very, very good examples from the UK, for instance, of the water minerality directly affecting the beer. Mm-hmm. And they're very, very protective of that.
Wherever you find good water, you find a really good brewer, right? You find good breweries, sake breweries, you find good quality sake. So on that note, where do we go with the water? I mean, looking at the water, clearly the first thing you look at is the minerality, right? So your different water sources, mainly coming from kind of subterranean water sources, either kind of, you know, quite shallow levels, quite deep levels, being pumped up through wells. That's the traditional way of actually kind of sourcing the water for sake. And of course, this water originates in a nearby mountain, right? Which originates as rainfall. You've got all this minerality in there, and we know that the minerality in the water drives the fermentation, right? You get different kind of speeds of fermentation. You get different kind of styles of sake from the actual minerality in the water. And probably apart from that, you also get characteristics from the water. If you look at, for example, I went to a brewery in Hyogo Prefecture, which is right on the coast, right on a bay. And they have a really clear salinity in their sake. And I said to him, I said, this reminds me of the sea. He said, yeah, sometimes because of recent earthquakes, the ground kind of, you know, creates little cracks, and some of the sea minerals get into the, not into the water itself, but into kind of like the soil or the channel or whatever. And somehow it gets into the water. And we've tried everything to get rid of this salinity. We just can't. It's there, whether we like it or not.
I know of a lot of breweries that pride themselves on talking up the point that they source, you know, water that is very close to their brewery. And they may not use the specific word terroir or anything like that, but they certainly like to focus on that point. And I think that's another differentiation factor, you know. I would just add that.
Right.
You know, the importance that water plays, locally sourced water plays into how an end result of sake comes out is just huge. Like it's a very big significance what water plays in sake terroir. A good example I can think of right now is Asamai Shuzo from Akita, where they only use rice and water sourced from within 5 kilometers of the brewery.
Right.
And I think they take on, I guess, what we would call like a domain style, I think, in the wine world, where the rice is grown kind of almost on site. And then the water is sourced from within the brewery. And I could only speak for myself, but there's like a very good, there's a clear consistency of, I guess you would say, the minerality and then the texture and then the overall sort of flavor profile of the sake, which I believe, without much scientific evidence to bring to the table at the moment now, is a good example, is a good showcase of what terroir is able to achieve.
For some of our listeners that don't know, in Japan, there are two types of water, basically. There's kind of like a female water, which we call onnamizu, and then there's male water, which is otokomizu. And let's look at otokomizu first, because one type of otokomizu is very, very famous. You may have heard of miyamizu. which originates in Hyogo Prefecture. And it is basically the thing which undoubtedly gives Hyogo Prefecture its very kind of hardened, rich style. And Miyamizu is actually found by a brewer who was brewing in two different plots of land, okay? And he was doing everything the same to make his sake. He was a toji, make everything. He said, I've got the same people, same techniques, same rice.
Same volume.
Same volume. What's going on here? Why am I getting a different quality of sake? Much better quality of sake at this different plot of land. And then after, you know, trial and error, it hit him. It was the water. And the water that he was using in one of the places was actually traveling along what used to be the seabed. And it was picking up minerality from the seabed.
Oh, wow.
And that was imparting characteristics in sake. And Miyamizu is very famous. I mean, that's what pretty much defines Hyogo Prefecture. Sake. And then you have the opposite, which is Fushimizu, right? From which comes the underground water channels in Kyoto, in Fushimi. And it's the opposite, isn't it? But it's very kind of soft, very simple, very kind of light styles of sake. Very soft, isn't it?
Compared it's to not the softest one.
No, it's not the softest
Hiroshima
one.
Hiroshima is building a story about around soft water and Saiju in particular.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you've got historically the water definitely plays a big part in sake brewing. Do we have any arguments for maybe why water wouldn't be the sake tewa? What's the problem with establishing water as the sake tewa? Is there any?
The only problem is that if you go from one place to another, which is only a few hundred meters away, you can get a very different water. So then you have a terroir which is associated to a very narrow place. And even sometimes you have breweries that are taking water from two different wells and there are different waters. So that's the limit, but I think it doesn't fundamentally play against what we're saying, which is that water plays a very important role in the characteristic of the sake, and so it's part of the terroir of sake.
I think a big problem is that a lot of these mountains straddle more than one or two prefectures.
So you've
got a prefecture next door claiming that they produce the same characteristics from the same water. Then, of course, you lose the idea of a terroir because, you know, the guy, he can make the same sake. Where's your terroir gone? Where's your identity gone now? And there's not a problem with that. Why does the terroir have to be such a small area? Maybe it could be a bigger, you know, maybe it can be more of a range we can give to the terroir.
You know, talking about water, I think it is really difficult to define terroir in terms of water because of that reason exactly. And for example, with the brewery I'm working at right now at Chiyo no Kame Shuzo in Ehime Prefecture, there's another brewery very close to us in the same exact town. And our water sources are different. And the final product is very different, despite the fact that, you know, obviously there's other factors that come into play, production techniques, you know, the yeast being used, things like that. We both use the same rice in certain brews, but yet produce a very different final product. And I think for that exact reason, it would be hard or difficult to say that, okay, you know, all of sake from this prefecture, from Ehime Prefecture, tastes this way because they all use the same water. Even a prefecture is huge. And just within a town, you can get very different water characteristics.
Right. What I'm saying is the terroir of your brewery and the terroir of the brewery next door is different.
Absolutely.
And that's because I totally agree. That maybe the house style is overruling.
There's so many different. I don't think it's any one factor. I think there's again, the production comes into play, the type of rice being used, the yeast, house style, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
One final point I'll make about maybe championing water as the sake tewa. Your problem you have here is that you can use any water to make sake.
Right. Or you can filter water.
All you have to do is filter it.
Doesn't have to be spring water.
There's a big problem with a lot of breweries losing their natural water sources because of infrastructure. I'll give an example here. Shizuoka Prefecture right now is having infrastructure because for the linear motor car. And there's a big kind of, you know, I think maybe they come to an agreement, but I think they're going to lose a certain area, which includes part of their natural water sources. And I know a lot of breweries don't use natural water sources. You know, they just use whatever's, you know, some of them actually
some places don't think
water.
About it at all.
No, yeah, there you go.
Or what they'll do is, and I don't know if this is the same in the shochu world, but a lot of breweries will perform reverse osmosis on the water, which essentially strips the characteristics of that water.
Right. It neutralizes
Yeah. And it's not a bad thing. They do it because they want to remove any minerals that could potentially have a negative impact on the brewing. But that certainly kind of can strip some of the characteristics that are, you know, perhaps unique to that water or that region. Right. And I know a lot of breweries that do that within Japan, and that's not a bad thing.
Should we move on maybe to yeast then?
Yeast.
You want to start us off on yeast?
Sure. So yeast, I think, is another part of the equation that can be discussed, certainly. And one of the reasons is because yeast, you have yeast that are specific, at least within Japan, specific to certain prefectures, certainly specific to certain breweries as well. We all know about, you know, breweries that pride themselves on using yeast that's only found, say, you know, within that brewery that's been growing there for hundreds of years. I can speak to at least, you know, Ehime Prefecture and some of the yeast that we use at Chiyonokame. We use a yeast called EK7, which is developed by the prefecture and is not, it's very carefully guarded. It's not sent out to any other prefectures. And so in that sense, you could say that, you know, some of the flavor and aroma profiles that are unique to that yeast are unique to that region. You know, the nearby prefecture, Kochi Prefecture, there's a lot of breweries, they're doing the same thing, using yeast that is specific only to that prefecture. And you've got, again, the you know, these research institutes that are part of the prefecture, have government funding, what have you, and they have you know, special institutes where they're developing and perfecting the yeast.
There's definitely something going on with regional identity creation here, isn't there? Absolutely. Nearly every prefecture in Japan now, you see some, whether it's new varieties of rice or new varieties of yeast or even koji, and we'll talk about that in a sec. It's, you know, you've got this trying to create a regional identity that sets them apart from the prefecture next door, or, you know, and makes sake easier to, you know, to find that sake that suits your particular taste preference. If you understand what kind of style that prefecture is creating, then it makes it easier to kind of, you know, it will make sake more accessible. There's no doubt about that.
It's fun for the consumer. It's certainly enjoyable for the consumer, absolutely. I would argue, because you have a chance to try a sake that's only be produced in that region, more or less.
I forgot to mention when we were talking about the rice, actually, a really, really important point is that sake brewers could not grow their own rice until very recently. There was a law put in place after the war, 1942, I think it was, the Staple Food Act, which forbid brewers growing their own rice to protect the agriculture, the farmers. And it's degraded over that time. It's kind of, they've loosened the rules until now where brewers can actually grow their own rice. I think first they loosened the rules so that they could source their rice from a local farmer and they didn't have to buy it from the cooperative, which was the case before. And now they can grow their own rice. Before, you can grow your own rice, I mean, you can't even have a discussion about tewa. So that's a big change. So just throw in there. Where does the koji come into all this? We need to talk about the koji because sake has to be made with koji. So where does the koji? And koji, of course, is a massive ingredient in shochu as well, right? You've got three different types. So probably more so in koji because you have these three different types. Or we are using the white koji in sake brewing now as well. But where does the koji come into that? I mean, can we say there's maybe a tewa with the koji? I mean, is that a stretch? What do you think?
I know of a couple of small distilleries that I'm not at liberty to say which ones, but they're experimenting with basically kuratsuki koji, and they're just letting it naturally go. See what happens, and there's some wild stuff going on, and it's in these really tiny koji rooms that they've been using for generations, and we could debate the level of cleanliness in a couple of them, but that's probably part of it.
It creates a unique koji. Yeah.
Oh, so it's amazing.
Yeah. Whether or not it's, you know, clean or sterile.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter.
Sometimes they have this thing, right, on the wood in the koji room that they paint over to try and, like, they varnish over something to try and stop it from affecting the flavor of the koji. But yeah.
Well, a lot of sake breweries are not using cedar koji rooms. Mm-hmm. Chiyonokami is another example. And a lot of more modern breweries are, I would say, you know, kind of shying away from that because it's more difficult to clean. So they're opting for, you know, whether it be stainless steel or different materials, so that they can have a really clean room and you know, clean it more easily. It's difficult to clean cedar.
maybe we have to explain to our listeners that the reason why we're spending time talking about the koji room and the way koji is made is because the mold itself, the koji kin, is basically a limited number of products. I mean, it's most always bought outside from a lab, and brewers will use similar products from one side of the country to the other. I'm mentioning that, and at the same time, I'm thinking of people like Terada Honke, for example.
Yeah, I can think of a number.
Who are actually collecting some mold from rice fields and turn that into to make koji.
Right.
And
spoiler alert, koji, I found this out recently, koji kin is found on the ears of the rice, if you didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's where they get it.
And and so they produce a particular sake based on that natural koji kin that is in the rice field next to the brewery.
So in Hyogo Prefecture, this shrine, was it the Niwata Shrine, they recently found some new koji strain there, and they've started making sake based on that.
That's
koji
awesome.
That found. Yeah.
That's cool.
You're
going
to see this increase, definitely, because no one wants to be limited by the same strain. We really wanted to ask the koji maker, one of the koji makers, we'll do in another episode, kind of what their take is on this, but
it's a great story. I mean, if you build the terroir sake, you want to have your own koji kin.
Oh, absolutely, and your own yeast, and your own water.
But how could the koji possibly influence the end style of the sake? And it all comes down to, well, if you have different levels of humidity, you're going to have different mold growth, and the more the mold grows, the more kind of enzymatic, activity you're going to have. And that will either give you a more kind of glucose-rich sake or kind of less glucose-rich sake. It has a massive impact on the end product. We've got to talk about people, surely. The people who make the sake, who brew the sake. I mean, we said how style is a massive, has a massive impact on the end flavor, maybe more so than the raw ingredients. People, I mean, they've always played a massive role in... I mean, a lot of breweries have this blurb, right? And they say the same kind of thing. They say, we'd like to impart the passion of the brewer into our end product. You ever seen that, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And that says it all for me. So,
so when you say people, though, you're talking
about... Yeah,
let's
focus a bit more.
Yeah, so when you... how do you define people? You're defining it as essentially the labor of love that goes into the creation of the product, or are you talking about the skill set of the people that are working, or is it all of that?
So we have the toji system, right?
And then there's also the toji style. Yeah.
We have to look at the toji style, because I mean, pretty much all the sake styles that exist today in most parts of Japan, I think, or most of Japan, with a lot of exceptions, of course, most of the styles we're familiar with have been determined by a particular toji guild, right?
And we'll have been influenced to a certain degree.
And of course, because the original system is that half a year, this toji would go off and work at a particular brewery, and probably the brewery would probably hire the same toji, numerous times. And the brewery itself would take the hands off, it would be a hands off approach, right? Traditionally, we wouldn't get involved with the sake brewing. So it's the toji that really defined the end style in that particular brewery, in that particular prefecture, even. So you actually have particular toji styles, right? You have the Nambu style, you have the Tamba style, the Izumi style, Izumo style, sorry. You have the Ishikawa style as well. So, I mean, what do you reckon? I mean, people, how much does the people, in the wine world as well, people is a big part of the terroir, isn't it?
There are definitely some styles across regions. But here in sake, it's so obvious to me that the local toji, the toji system and the facts that toji were gathering korabito from a particular region, a particular village sometime, teaching them one particular way of making sake has a strong influence on the style of the sake. There's absolutely no doubt.
So people is kind of a tick, really, isn't it? Well, it's hard to kind of pick that up in the end product, right?
Yeah. Right.
I think it is.
Now, what is it? Nambu Bijin says that their sake is very sunny because their brewers have a very sunny, disposition to kind of impart that into the sake.
I think that's a huge part of the end product, though, because, it is a common discussion. If you have people making, whether it be sake or any food product for that matter, that they hate their job, they're, you know, having a terrible time making it, and, you know, are just miserable the entire time, the final product is not going to taste very well. And it's discussed in sake as well. You know, they talk about, you know, differences in the passion and sort of the, like you said, with Nambu Bijin, the internal, say, whether it be culture or just how the people are, you know, interacting and how they feel about their job and how that can influence the final product. So I think it's, I don't know if you can trace it back to terroir or not, but I think it's an important part of the production process, certainly. Yeah.
And if you want to use the terroir as a marketing tool, and we'll talk about it at the end about, you know, the argument for terroir in the first place, but yeah, if you want to use it as a marketing tool, I mean, talking about the people is a very, well, good, yeah, it's a great
absolutely.
Way to relate with the consumer, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of consumers have their favorite brewer, don't they? You know, like, and they drink this, because they like the brewer. They like the personality of the brewer.
They like the farmers, too. If you introduce them to the farmers, if you tell that story, that's a very sexy, very attractive narrative for a lot of consumers. So. Mm.
And I think this is going to probably increase and probably become stronger as we go forward, especially with this increase in owner Toji, right? So the brewery itself is actually the Toji as well. And that's going to definitely lead to kind of stronger terroirs, I think, in the future. Let's briefly, because I think...
At the same time, this plays a little bit against the Toji style story.
Right.
This individual brewer is not necessarily... was necessarily True. Trained in True. The style that
True.
Used to be the style of the region.
They pick their own, really, don't they?
Yeah, it becomes more a personality thing, doesn't it?
Most often they develop their own personality.
But surely that gives you more of a potential to create a terroir, because if you have one Toji guild, and they're massive at the end of the day, you know, you have this massive area of Japan that's making sake in a particular style. Whereas if you, with the Oni Toji, you can have just this one brewery basically making sake in a particular style. And a much stronger argument for a terroir, I think.
Well, and you have regions that don't have any Toji guilds. There's a probably
a
majority
lot,
of them now.
Tokyo being
right.
one of them.
Well, I mean, yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, those guilds are dying out. Yeah. Ehime used to have a guild. It's since disbanded. And so you have... Toji, or not even people that are Toji necessarily, they're just the head brewers. They don't have the Toji certification, and they're not necessarily following any specific techniques that are unique to that region.
What about the argument that the Toji system may have even restricted the terroir up until now? If you have, you know, a pressure to actually use a particular style of Toji guild in a particular area, you don't even have the freedom to even explore terroir. Right? And you don't have this in the wine world, right? You don't have anything like the Toji system in the wine world, do you?
I'm not aware of anything like that.
No, I've never heard of anything like that.
But I think there are maybe loose similarities in that, for example, in one French appellation, you have to use certain types of grapes and then certain ratio of blending, right? So it's sort of like it does deviate from a people element, but I think in saying that a loose... a vague general, vague geographic region must produce certain style of whether it be wine or sake. I think you can draw loose connection to what the Toji Guild perhaps traditionally was trying to accomplish. And I don't know if I could stretch it as far as to say it impeded the growth of terroir movement, but I guess you could say that Toji would often share techniques, or if, you know, they were experiencing, for example, a poor harvest year, they would try together and put their ideas collectively so that as a state or as a region, they can overcome adversities. So I think in that sense, it probably created a more cohesive or a more collective flavor profile in a certain region. Versus
we're not trying to belittle the Toji system. We love the Toji system. We wish it could be around for much longer. We hope we find ways for it to be around much longer, because it's an excellent system, and, you know, some amazing styles from it. Why do we even need to have this debate in the first place? I mean, why do we even need to have a terroir in the sake world? And why is this, you know, such a big buzz word right now in the industry? And I guess it's because there are a lot of smaller breweries where they're kind of the only way that they can really set themselves apart from the bigger breweries, at least in the eyes of the consumer, is kind of to have a regional identity, right? And I think there, they have less pressure from the consumer. They can be a little bit more experimental. They can experiment a little bit with the idea of a terroir, right? Big breweries, if they suddenly changed their entire style, can you imagine that? I mean, it just logistically, that just wouldn't happen. And maybe on a future podcast, we should definitely get the opinion of some bigger breweries. But generally, I don't think bigger breweries really go into this dip. There are examples.
Not yet.
There are some small examples, right? Kikumasamune, they did like a project where they made one special brand, and it was all about using local ingredients, locally sourced ingredients, things like that. And I think Hakai-san as well are doing something as well, aren't they? But generally, this tends to be a craft brewery, a small brewery thing. And I guess in the shochu world, it would be the same, right?
Yes.
More the small distilleries. So what do you think? Consumer demand? I mean,
I think not all consumers are aware quite yet of regionability or terroir, whatever you want to call it, how it plays out in sake. I think that when your smaller breweries are using locally sourced ingredients as much as possible, a lot of times they're doing so for a lot of different reasons. You know, playing into the whole sustainability. Not fad, but you know, sustainability is a good thing. They want to source locally as much as possible. And then when they push that out and when they focus on that, I think there are a lot of consumers that, you know, whether they're sake fans or not, if they see on the bottle that this brewery is using 100% locally sourced ingredients, or they're using rice that's specific to that region or whatever it is that's specific to that region, they then want to, they're curious and they want to give it a try. So I would say that the demand can be there, but it, whether it's there or not, it certainly can pique the consumer's interest.
And demand may be driving the current demand for the terroir. Like you just used the S word, the sustainability word. That could be a big driving force for the current kind of boom in terroir in the sake world, because I think that's a big thing in any agricultural industry, but in particular the sake industry. And yeah, that could definitely, going forward as well, that could definitely drive this. Sebastian?
I mean, we've discussed at length how terroir for sake, in the sense that, in the meaning of the word, the origin of sake goes far beyond the ingredients that make sake, because it includes techniques and other things. However, I do believe that in most people's mind, terroir as a word remains associated with the ingredient, the main ingredient, the raw material.
Yeah.
And this movement toward highlighting a terroir, or using the terroir word in association with a sake, goes hand in hand with the fact that more and more brewers are getting control of their rice supply.
Yeah, definitely.
You mentioned it throughout the podcast, but and in other podcasts as well. But all of this is clearly connected. So, if rather than buying your rice from a cooperative, if you're contracting it, or better, if you're making it, you want to say it, and that's why you want to use the terroir word or something similar to it.
Definitely. It's when you've actually got your own kind of identity and you've got your own brand that you need a marketing tool, right? And that's where the kind of the terroir thing comes in. But maybe they don't need to use the word terroir in the sake industry. Maybe we can find another word. Maybe we can find a unique, better interpretation of
a Japanese word.
Wouldn't that be nice? A Japanese word. Which sake might work, but I mean, it already has the connotations attached to it.
We always have a debate in French that you don't have in English about how do you call a sake brewery, a kura.
Oh, I heard this from Sylvain the other day.
You call it a brewery,
right?
And I don't know where it's coming from.
You call it a brasserie.
But in France,
brasserie
brings something with it that some people, including Sylvain, don't like. And I don't use brasserie as a
word. I think of a restaurant when you say brasserie.
I use maison, which comes from the wine world, but it's not perfect.
You use it in the fashion world as well, don't you? Maison for the fashion world. Well.
So, we have the same problem.
I like our language to adopt kura as a word. And then comes an important question. Is it le kura ou la kura?
My main point was
Maybe we should try to find, and I don't know if it exists in Japanese today, but a Japanese word to express express that.
Mm. Maybe we should give some honorable mentions, because there's no way we're going to get through every single element of today's podcast. We'll give some honorable mentions. We could have talked about climate, but I think in reality, Japan has a wide variety of different climates, and probably we should do an entire podcast on microbes.
Right. Yep.
I mean,
that's another rabbit hole
cheese
there.
Making, lactic acid is the thing that gives you the terroir, right? So it's kind of what the grass that the cows are eating, and then the lactic bacteria inside them, that's what actually gives you this these unique flavors, whatever. Mm-hmm. Those are the honorable mentions. I don't think there was anything we missed. We did actually get through quite a lot of the elements. Let's just kind of finish up by talking about the very briefly, kind of like we're saying, you know, so what are the merits, you think, of having a terroir in the sake world?
It's a great story.
Mm.
Story.
Mm. Yeah, and I think from an international marketing perspective, you really need that story. You really need to be able to talk about the place.
Right.
If you really want people to care about your product.
Mm. And then the philosophy that goes into it.
Exactly. And you can't be at, you know, Vin Expo coming up, you know, in France and people ask you, oh, okay, where's your rice made? And you go, well, I'm not really sure. That just doesn't compute.
And breweries really struggle with this, right? When they're trying to sell the sake overseas, they can't really give the kind of a spiel that will allow the consumer to identify with their product. They do need that story. And I think probably that's why a lot of breweries do end up using the word terroir, because instantly it kind of, you know, people overseas, they connect to that and, oh yeah, okay, you have a terroir. I get it. Okay, that's cool. But the story is definitely key. What else? Marie, any other?
I think the embracing the idea of terroir kind of gives breweries a bit more creative latitude, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so perhaps it's like a micro, what's a good way to put it? So if the Toji style was a bit more macro and a bit more regional, spanning over several different prefectures in certain cases. Speaking of terroir gives each brewery and each more micro regions more control of expressing themselves more freely and more explicitly, perhaps. We talked about like each brewery, for example, to Eli's point earlier on, each brewery having their own terroir, even if they're located in the same city. So I think embracing this movement toward terroir or more acknowledgement of terroir gives each brewery a chance to, if they want to, explore different styles, different expressions that is only unique to them. And coming back to the story bit, yeah.
That would be amazing, wouldn't it? That would be really cool. And what about in your brewery's case, Eli? Like, is this part of the brewery's mission?
It's a huge part of our mission.
Oh, wow.
Do you use the word terroir?
We do not. We don't. So Chiyo no Kame sources, they pride themselves on sourcing locally grown organic rice. And they like to highlight that in the ingredients section on the label, certainly. Another way they do it is also, again, you know, we were talking about the yeast, through highlighting that they use a yeast that is, at this case in point, specific to Ehime Prefecture. And we also talk about water as well, and how we source water that's from, you know, very, very close to our brewery. There's a beautiful river running nearby and all of that. So, for our brewery, while we don't use that, that particular word, it's a huge part of the story and a part of our, marketing, materials and how we promote, this and sell the sake.
I guess my merit would be a single origin. And it's often called a single origin. Right now, especially in the sake industry right now, where you still have a lot of breweries that use rice from other prefectures, or, you know, I think that confuses the consumer. And I think it's easier when you've got a single origin, when all the ingredients come from one place. Mm-hmm. And also then it allows you to connect more to the place. Then it gets you interested, you know. And in Japan, you have a lot of rural areas which are struggling with, you know, reduced populations or whatever. You've got the big population, aging population problem in Japan. That's one way of maybe a solution to that problem, making people more interested in that particular region, right? When you're talking about the sake, when you've got to talk about Yamanashi from Hyogo Prefecture, it moves you away from that region. It's no longer just about that region. I find sake with single origins so much more identifiable, so much easier to connect with than sake where the rice is being plucked from here, there, and everywhere. And maybe psychologically, if anything, you can pick that up on the palate.
I enjoy drinking sake that uses ingredients that are unique to that region. It's for me personally, it's just a little more fun and interesting to do because I usually do find differences in the flavor profile. So, and I would say to your point about the demand of rice and how that is, you know, could be tied back to supporting that local economy. If we have a brewery that's using all local ingredients and the demand for that sake increases, then that means the demand for that rice increases, you know, and so the brewery is able to support the local farmers. It's a harmonious, kind of marriage or exchange of skill sets and exchange of services and things. So I think, I think it's great to source those local ingredients as much as possible if it supports the type of sake that you're trying to create as a brewer. I hope that we see more of it.
Let's not forget the original Toji was a rice farmer.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think breweries still have a choice. Some of them make the choice of becoming, I'll call them terroir breweries in a sense of a better word, and that's because the word of the day, but producing sake with a local style only that they define, arguably, local rice only and so on and so forth, as what you do down there in Hime. But others still have the choice to have a production from rice sourced from other parts of the country, and on part of the production only, release a market that has a strong single origin image, to use that word, which I actually like. So that's a flexibility which is a great tool to play with and slowly maybe drive the brewery and the brand towards something different.
And that's got to help with the survival of these smaller breweries as well. And let's not forget that the industry is not out of the dark ages as far as, it's not really growing in the way we might want it to. So this could help a lot of smaller breweries to kind of grow. And do you have the same, is that the same in the shochu?
Just before you answer that question, Chris, because what I meant as well is not only it's a choice in terms of marketing, but it corresponds to reality, changing the rice you're working with, changing the water or the elements you're working with is a risk. You have to if you want to keep the quality level, you will be sweating to see the results. So it's got to be a controlled slow process. You cannot just switch like that.
And right. Challenging is a new thing in the industry as well, isn't it? Right? Traditionally, not in a bad way, but just, it was easier just to kind of make your sake from rice being sourced from the co-op, whatever you got, get your hands on. And you didn't really want to take that risk. You didn't have to. Right?
And also, there's a reason why Yamada Nishiki, for example, is called the king of sake rice, right? I mean, not only does it yield good sake, but also it's easy to handle. And that's a primary lower risk rice. Effectively, so that's an absolute benefit if you are a producer, and to Sebastian's point, you don't want to risk that by trying perhaps a newer strain of a local rice that you're less familiar with the rice composition, how it's going to behave, its minerality, so on and so forth. So
Kamino-o or something, right? You start using Kamino-o, that's a real challenge, isn't it, for brewers, because they don't know how it just doesn't behave itself. It just does what it wants to do. You have no idea how it's going to do in the brewing.
And using locally sourced ingredients, especially rice, isn't always the cheaper option. I'd just like to highlight that as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the breweries that are using locally sourced rice that pride themselves on that, they're taking a risk, like you said, in terms of how the rice can react and how the final product comes out, but they're taking a risk financially as well, because they're essentially saying that we care enough to spend a few extra bucks, or not just a few, quite a lot sometimes. And we think that that's important. We think it's important to support our local, economy and local farmers. And that at the end of the day, the consumer cares about that as well. And they think that it creates a product that the consumer, it'll resonate with the consumers. So
you can't just switch.
It's very risky.
You can't just decide suddenly overnight to start growing your own local rice either. It takes 5 years, right, to convert these fields to actually be suitable for growing sake rice. Even if you have a sake rice field to begin with, you've still got to change the soil composition or whatever, you know, and it takes, I heard it takes 5 years or maybe it takes a bit less in some cases. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question, sorry, Chris. So in the shochu world, do you have the same kind of, you know, thing? Does it help smaller distilleries to kind of survive? You know, is the shochu world healthy?
I would say that they've plateaued and they're losing like a percentage point every year. But the way that I would look at it is that the smallest distilleries are fine. They make what they make. They've got ardent fans. They can sell their product every year. That's not a big concern for them. The big distilleries, the big boys, they're fine too. Because they have the resources, they have the economies of scale to maintain their margins. They'll create new markets if they need to. It's the middle folks who are in big trouble in the shochu world. They are trying to make it to the next step, but they don't have the same economies of scale. They don't have the same raw human power and the human hours to be able to devote to all these different things. And yeah, money's a huge thing as well. So absolutely, these mid-range places need this type of thinking. They need to figure it out on their own. And just like in the sake world, you know, if they can figure it out, everything gets better for everyone. But demographic time bomb for everybody. And we need, the writing's on the wall. It has been there forever. We need foreign markets and nobody knows how to do that. So it's a pretty wild, they're just throwing pasta at the wall right now. So,
well, you know, we didn't claim at the beginning of this podcast that we were going to be able to conquer this topic in one go, right? Impossible. There's still so much exploration of the terroir going on. There isn't a definite answer to the question, should sake have a terroir and what is it? You know, how will it be shaped in the future? And that's why there will definitely be more podcasts on this topic. So you can look forward to that. We'll try and dive deeper into some of these elements in future podcasts and get some actual insight as well, direct from the breweries. Then we can give more of a kind of informed view on that. So thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chris.
It's been a pleasure. For having
me. It's a pleasure being here.
And as always, this podcast is possible with the support from the Sake and Shochu Makers Association here in Japan. And we occupy their lovely information center to do this recording. And with that, we'll see you in another episode of, or you'll hear us in another episode of Sake On Air. And we can be found on all the social media platforms with the hashtag, the handle at Sake On Air. And everyone's kind of Instagram handles and everything, we'll put those on the website. Is that okay? Thank you everyone for joining me on this topic. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we will see you next time on Sake On Air. Kanpai.